I'd like to begin with appreciating your efforts today and ask if the volume is good. Good. Okay. Appreciating your efforts today. Thank you. If we advertised the retreat, 7-day retreat, and all we did to describe what it would be like was the first day, probably very few people would come. How many of you were more tired than you expected today? How many of you, your body hurt more than you expected today? How many of you did your mind hurt more today than you expected? How many of you were more discouraged today than you expected? How many of you had more emotions and newer emotions than you expected? A few of you. I liken the first day of a retreat often, not always, it varies from retreat to retreat, how it goes for people. But on the, on the average or something, it's kind of like when I used to go backpacking in the Sierras. And generally, when you go there in the Sierras, the first day you have to go up. And your backpack is full and heavy of food. And it's hard going. But once after the first day, things begin kind of evening out, smoothing out. The body gets used to it. And it's a huge transition here. It's a very different thing to be here than how it is for most people to live their normal lives. To be able to, change your sleep schedule, to change your eating schedule, to be around people in silence, just to be in silence and not talk the usual we have, to not be involved in the usual distractions, entertainments, challenges that we have. These are all it's a big transition, and it's kind of like cultural shock for the whole system sometimes. So you did well, all of you, and I appreciate all of you for your engagement and that you're still here. Thank you. The theme for this retreat is the 7 factors of awakening. And 7 factor awakenings are said to arise out of mindfulness practice. As mindfulness practice develops, it grows, and these grow into such a point where they become more prominent in the mental landscape, so that they become jewels, they become treasures, they become something that feels wholesome, nourishing, inspiring, very valuable to have these qualities of mind, heart, standing out strongly. And it's often presented as something as a byproduct of the practice as the mindfulness deepens and grows and all that. So it isn't so much that you have to make yourself have the experience of the 7 factors of awakening, but it is good to know what they are so you can appreciate them, even if they just start showing in hints, a little bit, because the recognition of what's wholesome is often the very thing that supports it to keep growing and developing. But if we overlook it or dismiss it, then chances are it's not going to grow and become a resource, support for us. The 7 factors of awakening are mindfulness. Usually the second one is translated as investigation. Third is effort or energy. The fourth is joy. Then comes tranquility, calmness, and then happiness, concentration, and equanimity. And they're beautiful when they arise, and they can arise in different ways and patterns. Sometimes individual ones stand up and highlight. Sometimes people feel very tranquil and it feels very good. Sometimes there can be joy stands out and highlight. Sometimes a sense of concentration. You kind of get kind of in the groove of concentration, really feel here we are, we're concentrated, and that's what stands out. And sometimes mindfulness stands out. It's very strong, mindfulness, very clear. It's almost as if mindfulness has a momentum of its own, and it's not so much we have to apply ourselves to be mindful, We just have to kind of get out of the way and allow the whole system to be mindful. But I believe that these seven factors of awakening are always here. They're aspects, qualities, factors of mind. They're always close by, but they might be very teeny, very small, not very strong. Or they might be that they're just obscured by other things. There's just so many things that are covering them over that they can't be seen. And I use the language of covering over intentionally because in the teachings of the Buddha, he paired the seven factors of awakening with the five hindrances. Five hindrances are the ways in which we get entangled in desire, in ill will, aversion, in sloth and torpor, in restlessness and remorse, and in doubt. These, we always get caught up. This idea of being entangled in something, I hope I'll be able to convey to you in the course of this retreat, or this talk. And so the Buddha called these nivaranas. We translate it as hindrance. The literal meaning is to cover over. They're the coverings. And they cover over, they obscure, they make people blind, the Buddha said. They narrow the field of vision so we don't see widely and clearly. And the seven factors of awakening have the opposite effect. They're the process of uncovering. They're the process of unobscuring, of seeing clearly, of being awake, not being asleep, not having the eyes closed in a sense, but to see clearly. And so these two are paired. And one of the things that gets covered over by the hindrances are the seven factors of awakening themselves. One of the things that gets opened by the seven factors of awakening, uncovered as they get stronger, is how these hindrances operate and take over so we can be wiser about them. And so we can no longer be caught in their grip and be entangled. So the five hindrances are the ways we get entangled, meshed, glued to and wrapped in, preoccupied by things. And the seven factors of awakening is part of the disentangling process. Beautiful process to not be so much entangled anymore. And part of what we're doing in mindfulness practice is discovering how we do get entangled, how we get identified with things, how we think about things, how we feel about things, in such a way that we kind of get merged with the experience. So for example, I could be sitting here and feeling, noticing that my knees hurt, and which they do. And so I can sit there noticing it, and that's fine. And then I could be having thoughts about my knees hurting. And I can have thoughts like, you know, someone who's meditated as long as I have should be comfortable. And I'm probably not a good meditator because my knees hurt. If I knew exactly what I was doing, the knees wouldn't hurt whatsoever. And you know, and I certainly shouldn't let anyone on the fact that my knees hurt. That would not be good for my reputation. So all these thoughts can go on, right? So I could see the knee hurt and just be see it clearly. No, that's what's happening. I can see a thought arise. I've been meditating for a long time. I should know better and have my knees hurt or something. And I can just say, oh, there's a thought. That's interesting. Thank you for the news bulletin. And just let it go by. But I could start getting into this train of thoughts about the pain. And I'm so identified, so involved in, so wrapped up in those thoughts. And those thoughts are so wrapped up in the pain, they're not really distinguished from each other. And because they're not distinguished from each other, I'm not distinguished from it. And if I'm not distinguished from it, I'm kind of it. I'm kind of lost in it. I'm caught up in it. I'm defined myself by it. And the problem of the knee, the problems of the thoughts, become my problem. They reflect back on who I am and what I am and all kinds of ways in which they're all entangled. It's a lot easier overall to be mindful, if you're able to, the clear recognition of what's there. Just leave the pain to be pain. But the mind will do its thing, and so the mind has thoughts. And you see, oh, there's a thought. And clearly see the thought as a thought. Or I could have feelings about it. I could have feelings of all kinds of feelings. I could feel some aversion to having the pain. And I could say, oh, there's aversion. And so that recognition is, that is disentangled, unentangled. But if I get involved in these thoughts and poor me and why is it hurting and what this means for me and probably I'm going to need to have my knees amputated soon and my mind goes, you know, my mind has no, you know, sometimes my mind, if I let it do whatever it does, it's kind of like weird in there. You know, some teachers say that mind has no shame. I don't have any shame like that, but not for those reasons. But my mind does. I'm kind of friendly with my mind and what it thinks and what it thoughts it has. But it is kind of bizarre what it thinks sometimes. And I just kind of, oh, there it is. There's a thought. So the idea of it being entangled and the way in which the hindrances entangle us. I can have a thought and that's a good thought. I want that thought because that's a wonderful fantasy and that'll just put me in a good place and a wonderful situation in the world and I'll be so much better and happier and I get pulled into that world as opposed to just, you know, there's a thought, clearly seeing it. It's kind of like the thought is there and the observation is here. The image I have for this is if you're in a heated conversation in a group of people and for some reason you step away from the group, maybe some, you know, 10 feet, and you look back at them and you see, wow, those people are having a heated conversation, but you're not part of it anymore. And you feel like you're, you know, you have choice, should I go back in, should I not? Wow, they're really hot and sweaty, and that's quite something what they're doing there. But you're observing it from a distance, you're not it, you're not in the conversation anymore. So mindfulness is the ability to kind of see that clearly, that we're not entangled. It's easier said than done. It's even harder to do it when what's happening is difficult, when it's painful, uncomfortable, when it has major important repercussions in our life, some issue we're thinking about, and something that has, you know, has some value and important in and of itself, maybe. And so we get pulled into its world, and we're entangled, we're caught, and we get covered over. The aliveness, the vitality of the seven factors of awakening don't get revealed because they're covered over by these preoccupations. So there is something that I call the 1 second flashlight that you could try using. And the one second flashlight is to use a mental note, a label, to clearly label, clearly note what the experience is that you're having. So it could be very simple thought. It doesn't have to be a complicated label or it doesn't have to be exactly the right label. Close enough is good. And so if I was paining my knee, I would note pain. But just noting it pain is not the flashlight. The flashlight is when you really turn the light on the mind and you really see it, like the pain is there, and the flashlight is here, this shining light on it. It's really distinct. But pain. And sometimes if you, you know, and then I might go, you know, if I go pain, then I'm involved, I'm entangled. But, you know, but to neutral, clear, just like the flashlight is neutral, it just shines light on something. And to say, there's pain, or there's a thought. To clearly recognize your thinking. Now you probably, many people know their thinking and they're fighting their thoughts and they're trying to let go of their thoughts and they're trying to come back to their breathing. But it's seldom that they use the 1 second flashlight. That they really turn the light on and say, thought, I see you. Look thought right in the eye and say, thinking. That is thinking. It's kind of like you would say, that is thinking. And sometimes you might even do this in your mind. Say it silently to yourself, loudly. That was a thought. This is thinking, or this is, you know, frustration. This is frustration. And see if you can find in how you say it enough distance, enough freedom or independence that you're not entangled for 1 second. Step back. Kind of like step back and observe it, like looking at the crowd of people who are arguing. You step back and you really see. You might go back in quickly because you get pulled in. But for that 1 second, when you really kind of use that clear label, you know, the light is on, you see it clearly, and you're somehow disentangled for that moment. I find a particularly effective label when I, especially when thinking is, you know, out of control and I keep getting pulled into it, is I find it very interesting to use the label, wow. Wow. That's amazing that the mind is so out of control or so busy or so active. If I do that, wow, I lean back, like I'm leaning against the wall and looking at kind of cocking my head. Wow. It frees me from all these sticky ways that I get stuck to the whatever's going on or get caught by it or react to it or for and against it or try to make meaning out of it or some way unconsciously define myself by it or unconsciously put myself in the middle of it as if it's me or all kinds of ways that we get sticky. So the 1 second flashlight. And then you can do it again. And again. And again. This is a way to kind of a little bit free yourself up. Free yourself up from... And that's moving from the direction of being entangled to becoming disentangled. Or in the language of the Buddha, from being asleep to being awake. And these 7 factors of awakening are what come as we become more awake. So the first one, mindfulness, is this process of clearly recognizing what's here. Recognizing it and really being present for it. So we can really experience it, feel it, be with it, taste it, smell it, really kind of be here, but in such a way that in the clarity, the moment of clarity, moment that the flashlight is turned on, you have some independence or you're unstuck from it. Just this. Just this. This is what is happening. What that allows is the second factor of awakening, which is to see more clearly. And we use the word we translate often to English as investigate, which is fine. But it has a little bit more nuanced meaning in Pali, dhammavicaya. It means to distinguish the details of what's happening. It would be like, you know, when I was in Japan, they had these beautiful flower arrangements. They would have a little kind of like an altar-like space on the wall. And you'd go into a nice, peaceful room, and there'd be this flower arrangement of one flower. And that one flower stood out in highlight. You really saw the flower for the flowerness. Whereas often here in the West, if someone has flowers, they sometimes have a whole bouquet on the table. And it's beautiful, the bouquet, but in the big bouquet, all the flowers kind of are arranged together, and it's the whole thing that we see, rather than studying the detail of each flower. They're both good, but the idea, dhammavicaya, this investigation, is to start seeing the particularity of what's there, not the gestalt, not the, you know, the general idea of what's happening, but we want to get down and see what's actually the moment to moment, what's the actual details of the experience. So if I say that I have pain, I have lots of associations with how terrible pain is and you know, all kinds of ideas about pain and policies about pain and manifestos about pain and all kinds of things about pain and what it means and all kinds of things. But pain is a generalization. It's a kind of very category word that doesn't emphasize the particularity of the experience. So the particularity of the pain is that there's pulling and tightness, tightening and stabbing and burning and searing and, you know, all kinds of details like this, that you can go in and feel the particular details of it rather than taking kind of the general view of it. So if there's a lot of thought going on, you can experience the thinking. You can feel the energetics, how strong the energy, how fast are you thinking, or what's the mood of the thinking, or is there some parts of your body energized, activated as you do a lot of thinking? And that's distinguishing different aspects of the experience of thinking, as opposed to just treating it as just one big thing, you know, just thinking and the thoughts. And same thing with emotions. You can distinguish, what are the details of this? What's actually experience like? Because as long as I stay more generally with the idea I'm frustrated, it's too easy to slip into our thoughts. It's too easy to get sticky with it. And so, but if we can start seeing the particular details of actually the component elements of it, it's actually easier to be unstuck. So this investigation is not so much to go and analyze something, but to begin gently clarifying the different component parts, different aspects of the experience. So for example, I can be sleepy, and maybe I'm, and so the sleepy is just sleepy, but I don't leave it at that. I have all these ideas of what it means to be sleepy, and I'll just get sleepier, and I'll start nodding off in my meditation, and pretty soon, you know, it won't be very good for me, and I'll probably get a headache, and it's all this. And if I just treat that as just one big blob of events, I'm stuck to the whole show, it's very hard to unstick. But if I see, oh, there's sensations of heaviness, dullness in my face or my eyes, my mind feels swamp-like, kind of dull, and I recognize this from before, that this is a sign of sleepiness, and then I notice that there are thoughts. I assign meaning to this. This means that in an hour I'm going to be this way. Or I start making fantasies about how wonderful it would be to go to bed, and how can I plan to have the perfect bed rest, and start designing. Maybe I can go on Amazon and order velvet pillows, and will the manager allow me? And it'll come before the retreat's over, and it'll be great. And so then the investigation is saying, look, there's sleepiness, there's physical sensations, there's emotions that come with having sleepiness, there are thoughts that come with being sleepy. And as I begin teasing these apart, there's a less tendency to get swept up in them or tricked by them, that I'm supposed to be involved and participating and reacting and being for and against. And then the third factor of awakening is this energy comes a little bit from being engaged, interested in this process of disentangling, of using this capacity for awareness to start seeing more clearly what's actually happening moment by moment. And, you know, realizing this is a pretty good endeavor to do, because this being covered over, being entangled, being stuck to my thoughts and my feelings and my concerns, is not actually such a good deal after all. And I've done it long enough to know. And there's another game in town. There's another way of being. And so to feel inspired or feel kind of, okay, I'm going to really give myself to a different way of being. And it can just be that the energy is to use that 1 second flashlight. Find out where the switch is and really see, oh, this is what's happening. And then do it again. And I love the idea of the 1 second flashlight, because then you don't have to succeed continuously. Because that's another way people gets entangled. Like, I was supposed to be continuously mindful and stay in the flow, and I keep losing it. Well, 1 second mindfulness, you know, once you've done it, you can congratulate yourself. And then you do it again. So there's engagement in the process. And then there's joy. And joy can be very minor, kind of a sense of lightness, a sense of little bit of delight or a little bit of enthusiasm for what's happening. This feels good. And it can be quite strong. There can be waves of joy kind of cascading through the body. And there also, when there's joy start happening, all these things start happening. Are we getting entangled in that? Or are we using it to learn how to be disentangled? Are we getting stuck, or are we learning how to be unstuck? Are we learning to, you know, somehow narrow the focus of attention? Are we opening up so that we're more awake? And then with the next one is tranquility. It's usually associated with tranquility of the body. So a calm body. And as we get disentangled, there's more de-stressing. A lot of the stress that we have in our body comes from the ways that we think, the ways we get caught up in our thoughts. It's been said by psychologists that one of the leading causes of stress is rumination. And so there's caught up in thoughts and concerns and worries and being in that world. And so as that world starts to abate, as we become less entangled in it, then the system begins to calm down and settle and smooth out and release, relax, unknot. The knots begin to dissolve. And then as things get quieter, calmer, there's a happiness arises. And happiness is a very different feeling from joy. Happiness is closer to contentment than it is enthusiasm. So it's kind of contented, happy, settled, kind of a warm, nourishing, embodied feeling of well-being. And then there is concentration. That's something a lot of people who meditate get entangled with. The need to get concentrated, trying to get concentrated. I'm not concentrated enough. I should try harder. And I'm not. And then we get identified with being concentrated or not being concentrated. I'm a bad meditator, and it should be different. And I hope no one's watching me, because I just spent the last half an hour on some wonderful vacation in my mind, but I'm supposed to be concentrated. And it's a complicated world to get entangled with. In its essence, concentration is actually very simple. And just like with a 1 second flashlight, it's helpful to think of concentration as something that's very, very simple to do, and not to have a very high bar for doing it, but have a low bar, and then just keep doing it. So for concentration, there's the three breath journey. If you want to practice concentration, go on the three breath journey. That means just go ride, put your attention on top of where you experience your breathing, and ride on it for three breaths. Just three. It takes about 20 seconds or so, give or take a few seconds. Just do those three breaths. And maybe you can do three breaths and be completely content and happy. And then you do it again. And three breaths at 20 seconds of really being with your breath and knowing that that's all you're going to commit it to for the moment can make a difference. Things can shift internally. Things can shift away from the ways that we're caught up in, reactive, stressed. There can be enough of a shift for you to appreciate, well, that was a good journey, if you stay in those three breaths. If you can't do three breaths, do two. If you can't do two, do one. If you can't do one, do half. If you can't do half a breath, do something different. Then do the 1 second flashlight. So then this last factor of awakening is equanimity. And equanimity, the etymology of the Pali word means something like to have an overview of a situation. And it's kind of like the, you know, stepping back from the crowd of people who are arguing and then seeing it from a distance and no longer being in the argument yourself, but really seeing it, having this overview of it. And it feels so good not to be in that fray anymore, but just to see for what it is. So that's one of the meanings, is to have this overview, the clarity, and to feel in that clarity, in that overview, really is to not be reactive to what's there, not to be agitated by what's there. The mind doesn't get revved up or reactive or for and against the experience. And it can sound very dull to just be quiet and calm and non-reactive, not agitated, but there's something sublime about a still, quiet mind that observes and sees. It's really here, but doesn't waver in the middle of what's experienced. It's kind of like this, you know, looking into maybe a very, very clear river where the water just flowing very gently, and you see the fish, you see the rocks, and everything's so clear. It feels so good to kind of look into the clarity, and someone can look into that clarity for a long time as the water goes by. It's so nice. I have something like that, to be equanimous, to have this ability to not be entangled, but to watch what flows by the mind, the experiences that come and go, and to not have it impact the quality of the mind, to not have it be picked up or get glued or be pushed away, or to not get caught up in ideas of preferences and what we want and not want. Just to be there, just to let it go by and be independent of what the experience is. It's sublime, wonderful experience. So these seven factors of awakening then, as we learn to become, as we find ways to be less and less entangled, they start becoming clear. They start becoming more of our, you know, what supports us and helps us along. And they'll come and go to some degree. Sometimes they're very, as I said, they're not present at all. Sometimes they're very weak. But at times they can be stronger. Sometimes some of them are stronger than others. And when they're stronger, they might support you. You might want to call on it more and rely on it more. And, you know, when if your curiosity leads you to greater investigation, greater kind of distinguishing the details of things that are there, like you're imagining you're looking at that single flower, and just, you know, it feels kind of exquisite to go around and see. And so you do a walking meditation, and you feel, you know, your foot comes down and touches the ground. And you're no longer thinking, this is a step, you know, just this huge, big step, you know, like one big thing, idea of a step. That's just kind of abstract. But you're just as if that, the contact with the heel or the sole against the ground and the weight, shifting weight, like that's the single flower in its little altar. And you're just like, what, just that? And they just, you know, use that 1 second flashlight, just pressure, contact. So the investigation factors is just to let that detail stand out as if it's the only detail in the universe, that moment. And then it comes and it goes, and then you take in the next little detail, next detail. As opposed to thinking, I'm supposed to be stepping and now I'm doing a step and I don't know if that step was big enough, maybe I should do a shorter step, and I probably didn't learn how to step properly when I grew up, and someone's at fault for not teaching me the right stepping, and you know, and we're kind of like in this general, generic, kind of abstract idea of steps, and that's very removed from being awaked. That makes things obscure to be involved in that kind of thinking chatter. And so we're trying to step out of that obscuring forces of the mind, step away from the ways in which we get entangled or stuck. And some of the remarkable things about it is that maybe you need to look at me to an example. So if I make a fist, and this fist represents my biggest problem that I have in my life. This is like that. This is it, and this is an important problem. So I'm really concerned and preoccupied and all kinds of things. And the more I think about it, the more my fist gets tighter and tighter. But this is a good problem. It's a justified problem. Any self-respecting human being should have a good problem. And I got mine. And I'm not going to let it go soon. And I'm really into it. Whatever. In this problem. And I'm caught up in it, entangled in it. Along comes mindfulness. And mindfulness comes along like this. It comes from underneath, open hand, relax, and just supports it with awareness, just knows it's there. And if it feels supported, this fist, this poor fist, kind of feels itself more, it recognizes itself more, and it begins to, a little bit, begin to relax and soften. I haven't solved the problem. But it begins to, the tightening around it begins to soften a little bit. And that's nice. Also, as I feel it there, I start seeing, before I was in my problem, everything was a problem. The problem was the universe. I mean, that's where I lived. That's everything concerned was there. But as the mindfulness holds it, the awareness begins to be seen as something distinct from the problem. There's a problem and there's a knowing of it, being aware of it. I might use the 1 second flashlight to really, problem, that's a problem. For emergencies, I say, wow. I say wow long enough until it's really like amazing. That's a problem. Wow. And I was relating like I'm the first person in the universe who had a problem. Wow. Something. But what happens over time, as the mindfulness really holds and bees there, there's a shift of what's valuable. Rather than valuing the problem or thinking that's important to address the problem, we start feeling that what's valuable is the other hand that holds it. What's valuable is the awareness that's able to see it. And that makes a world of difference. And what happened, and that means that the problem doesn't have to be solved. We don't need to have an answer necessarily, but it's possible sometimes that the problem doesn't get solved, but it begins to dissolve. And not all problems need to be solved, but all problems in the context of meditation can be dissolved in a certain way. But whether they get solved, dissolved, or whatever happens to them, it's that other hand that becomes more important. The awareness, the knowing. And that other hand of awareness has certain qualities in it. It has the ability to make contact. Mindfulness. It has the ability to feel the different qualities of the fist. I can feel the knuckles, the individual knuckles as I do this. It has the ability to be energetically engaged in holding itself there against it. Lo and behold, there's some pleasure. In the right hand, there's some pleasure feeling the painful left hand. Soft, smooth. And the left hand is tranquil. There's some tranquility here. And might even be some happiness and nourishing feeling of having this nice, warm, tender, caring hand. And I'm focused on this. There's compassion maybe together with it brings concentration to stay there with the challenge that's there. And the right hand has no problems with what's going on. The right hand has no problem with the left hand problem. It just holds it. It's be there. It's equanimous about it. So there's starting to be a shift of orientation, where the orientation of the mind is not in the problem, not in how we're caught up in self-concern. Now we're caught up, shift away from our conventional desires that we have to how we are with the experience. It's not so much what we're seeing that is important now. At some point it shifts to the act of seeing becomes the important thing. And in the act of seeing, we start feeling the disentangling. We still have to see, but we start appreciating the act of seeing is so good. The act of knowing, the act of being aware, the act of being present for the experience. And that's where the factors of awakening begin to show themselves and support us. If we orient ourselves in the direction of our preoccupations, our problems, our desires, our fears, many of them might be very important and valuable even. I don't want to dismiss any of it. But if we orient ourselves there too much, that's where the obscuring can happen. The darkening or the closing of the eyes or the not seeing clearly. So to begin to appreciate this other dimension of our being. And there's a dimension of our being that's a lot of goodness in it. A lot of nourishing, a lot of inspiration, a lot of wisdom. Our Buddha was very clear. He said, what the hindrances hinder most is wisdom. And what the seven factors of awakening allow is wisdom. So this ability to step back, the 1 second flashlight, the 3 breath journey, to be equanimous, to feel the particularities of things and really kind of be there for it, really be present for the details of just this, is a way that kind of opens up the mind, opens up the heart, opens up our experience, so that then deeper wisdom can operate. That cannot operate when things are closed down. So to close, I'd like to say that to encourage you maybe to experiment with this 1 second flashlight to see if you can find a way of noting, not necessarily all the time, but just try it in different situations where the noting is clear enough, emphatic enough, that you really feel like you're getting unstuck from the experience. Really maybe sense you're stepping back, leaning against the tree, and just looking and seeing, oh, that's there. I'm here. So if you go down to the dining room and there's this, you know, you come out to the food, the buffet table, food is there. And, you know, you might use the note seeing. If you look at the food, that's what you're doing. So seeing. Can you say the note seeing clearly enough that you're not really leaning into the food, trying to analyze how much you can take without other people thinking you're being greedy, or kind of, getting all involved in it and leaning into it and thinking about it and noticing what other people take and how could they take so much? Just seeing. And then as you do this, it gives you the ability to notice something important. If you can do the 1 second flashlight clearly enough, then you might be able to see to the detail, to distinguish how you lose that clarity, how you get pulled into your thoughts, ideas, emotions, and entangled again. And that's also a place to learn wisdom, to see how that trick is done, to see how we get pulled in. You don't have to see it as wrong or bad to get pulled in and entangled again. If you watch how it happens, you're in a really good groove. That's fantastic. So even that one moment of being free is enough to give you the vantage point to see, oh, there, look at that. I just like came right back into those judgments. Wow. And then you do the wow thing. I hope you have a lot of opportunities for wow. Wow. It's a lot better than oh. So, thank you. So a couple of things.